Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 358. If you are a Patreon supporter, maybe you're watching this as a video, unless we didn't do that, in which case I edited this part out. but like maybe. And if you're wondering why there's a video, it might be related to a video that will have come out on our YouTube channel by the time you're watching this, about Star Fox's 30th anniversary. And we are secretly just using this episode as an excuse to also film us talking about Star Fox, and some of that may show up in that video.
Who knows?
Don't worry about it. Just roll with it. But today we're going to talk about the history of Star Fox, kind of celebrate its 30th anniversary, because this will be coming out like 3 or 4 days after it turns 30 in Japan. So yeah, just do a special episode of Connectivity. Yeah. Let's, before we get into the actual history, Neil, when did you first play legendarily perfect game that we all consider the best one ever, Star Fox on the Super Nintendo?
It was actually a lot later that I first played Star Fox. Would have been early 2000s when I bought my Super Nintendo at a flea market. And the game that I got with my Super Nintendo was a box copy of Star Fox on Super Nintendo. And it was revelatory in a way, because at that point I had played Star Fox 64, but I had not yet played the original game. And I've softened on the stance over the years, but definitely if you were to have talked to, you know, teenage Neil circa 2002, I would have been out there spitting hot fire about how the original Star Fox is so much better than Star Fox 64. When a little of that reality is just because Star Fox on Super Nintendo was the Star Fox game that I owned at that point.
Sure.
But even still, Star Fox on Super Nintendo was just like a weird fever dream of a video game that I don't think any other entry in the series has really captured. Like, you can see the experimentation come to life throughout the game, like the weird slot machine stuff. Star Fox 64, on the other hand, is also a great game, but a lot more, I don't know, focused and polished,
like cohesive. Like, it feels like they knew what they were doing going in. It has a the first one almost has a tone problem.
Because the first one is, I mean, you can tell, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, which you probably will, that Star Fox did not have the animal characters until near the end of development.
And yeah, I think that came later.
That shows. It shows that they were kind of like building this as they went. It wasn't something where they came in and were like, we're going to make a game where there's furry space puppets and they're fighting like a giant monkey. That's the video game.
Yeah. How much, I'm almost scared to ask, how much did you pay for your Super Nintendo at a flea market in 2000 or whatever?
I mean, it's
because I'll bet it was like disturbingly low by modern standards.
Yup. it might have been sub $50, and the Super Nintendo came in a box too.
Oh, did it have still, the styrofoam and everything?
Yep.
Great.
Yeah.
It's like a $300 purchase now.
Yeah. Roughly. Yeah. I do not remember exactly. And like everything's like it's beat up copies of both, or at least like the boxes, the box for the Super Nintendo and Star Fox were both beat up. But they, you know, I believe it had manuals, paperwork, all that jazz. And I think a memory is that I think it was like $35 to $40, which doesn't seem right. I feel like it might have been something like maybe the console was $35 and then I got Star Fox for $15 or something like that. But
yeah,
not triple digits, which is easily what that would cost now.
Well, you said the Star Fox was complete in box too.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's. Yeah, a couple $100 for that, several $100 for the Super Nintendo. Yeah, easily a $500 purchase today.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the Super Nintendo still works as of like a year ago. I still have that copy of Star Fox. It was my first Super Nintendo game in 2002. I was a Genesis kid.
Like
the Genesis was what was in my household. I played a lot of Super Nintendo at friends' houses, but it wasn't until I started getting loopy into Nintendo. You know, I mean, N64, I was all in on GameCube. I was all in on. And then in the GameCube era, because it was that you kind of learned that Nintendo had those sparse, like It's just going to be like a game or two for several months so that I started dipping more into retro stuff.
I feel like that's something that if you're like a younger person today playing, like maybe if like Switch is like your formative Nintendo console, that would be such a weird concept. Because now it's like there's like a first party or like first party adjacent title every month. And yeah, on N64 or like GameCube, N64, it was like a game a quarter.
GameCube had decent third party parity, but N64 was a lot because, you know, cartridges were so damn expensive to make that you would largely be like, all right, like Nintendo's got Star Fox coming out, and then 6 months later, Diddy Kong Racing or whatever. Now, I don't think it's that's his exact order, but it would be that, like, it would be once a quarter if you were lucky.
Yeah.
And then, like, maybe there would be like a Goemon's Great Adventure that would show up, which that is a game that I have a memory of buying on launch day because my copy was broken, and then I had to return it the next day, and they thought I like willingly broke it. I'm like, no, I took it out of the box, and it was just like the tab on the bottom broke, like I didn't even touch it.
That was a game I remember renting Goemon as a kid, and having no idea what I was supposed to do. I think I would just kind of systematically rent every N64 game. And so there were a bunch of them where I would just like boot them up and be like, I don't know what this is. But then you also get the weird like fever dream memories of like Chameleon Twist. And like that kind of that level of N64 game where I think back, I'm like, I think Chameleon Twist was awesome, but I don't actually know. Buck Bumble was in there, too. That was another one of those.
Buck Bumble, I think, was one of those ones that like my parents found like cheap somewhere and I randomly got for like an Easter basket or something.
Yeah.
But no, like, yeah, the first Goemon game that's basically just like weirdly prototype 3D Zelda. That game's incredible. Definitely very janky now. I haven't played it in a very long time, but like it's like a 3D game from 1997. Like it's not going to be polished, guys.
Right. Right.
But there is an ambition and a skill to that game that is preposterous. And like that game is very special to me. Goemon's Great Adventure is fine. That was the one that was the second one on N64. But that is essentially, if memory serves, just like a side-scrolling 2D game. And it was fine. It was just that I was kind of like hoping for more of this weird 3D adventure game.
Yeah.
And they simplified it, which is, I mean, probably I don't know. Maybe it was the wrong decision in the long haul because no other Goemon games after that.
They came killed over. The series.
Yeah. There might have been like a GBA game, I forget. But
yeah,
I know there was a PS2 game that was announced to be localized and then never was localized. But it was also like Goemon looked less cartoony, which what are we doing if that's how we're doing a Goemon game?
Should do it. Need to do a Goemon deep dive.
Yeah.
Make a Goemon documentary, Neil.
Okay. Challenge accepted.
So I was thinking about this, and the first time, so I'm going to make you feel old. So I was born in 1992. Star Fox came out in 1993. It is one
you
of the
played
first
it at 1 year,
right? It's one of the, I don't know when the first time I played it was, because it's one of the first games I can remember playing, like Star Fox, Donkey Kong Country, Mario Paint, and Mario World. Those are those four games I've just always played, and I don't remember a time before them. But I was thinking about this today, and Star Fox always stood out to me as a kid because I didn't have a high-end PC or anything. And so I had all of these games that were 2D, and then this one weird game that was completely 3D, which is, once again, it's a hard concept to explain in modern context. Because like it was like a thing that didn't exist on consoles. It would be like if today you had your selection of 3D games, and then you had this one random game that was in 4D and existed outside of time.
It was an AR cards, right. Man. That's what like, it was that's, like.
And like, so there's that one game that's like that, that's just weirdly on the same system that runs all your 3D games. So that's weird. And so that's what Star Fox was for me as a kid, is it's like this weird game that's totally different from all of the other ones. And even like, you know, we had Mario Kart, but like even as a kid, I remember thinking like, you know, this is This is still flat. It's just flat like this.
Mario Kart is it's like a 2D trick. Star Fox is legit.
Yeah, like Mario Kart, while it doesn't look like it, ultimately isn't actually that different from like a top down RC Pro-Am or something. That's all Mario Kart is. They've just taken the background and squished the back of it so that it looks like you're looking at it at an angle. Like, that's the only difference.
It's still mode 7, very cool, but it's not a true 3D game.
Yeah, and so Star Fox just stood out as this weird, bizarre thing that was just unlike anything else that existed. And probably is like the basis for like why I got obsessed with like video game graphics and rendering tech and stuff, because it was just so like, what is this? Why does it exist? How does it exist? It was bizarre.
Like, my first memories of Star Fox, like I can't even remember if I actually played it around when it came out, but it was one of those things where I remember seeing either maybe a demo in a store or coverage in a game magazine or something, and just not understanding how this could happen on a Super Nintendo.
And
it was the era we were starting to get into that cusp of, you know, PlayStation coming out and having, you know, what like some golf games, Battle Arena, Toshinden, some arcade games that were in 3D. But just imagining like old tech, like the Super Nintendo, like really showing forth that Nintendo, the Gunpei Yokoi style of lateral thinking of withered technology. That's what Star Fox felt like, even if, you know, the fact that they built the Super FX chip on it was, you know, they were making new technology, it wasn't old technology, but it was taking something that this shouldn't have been possible in a Super Nintendo. It was not planned to be a part of the Super Nintendo when that console was developed in the late 80s, but it became part of the Super Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. Which was a weird, the whole idea, like that's another thing that's a very strange thing to conceptualize now, is that idea that you could take a game cartridge and say, oh, our hardware isn't able to do what we want this game to be able to do, let's just put new hardware smack on the game and no problem. Because that's what the Super FX chip was, right? It's like, it's just extra, it was extra hardware for the Super Nintendo. Which
and Nintendo was doing that as far back as the NES too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a concept that only works because like the games at that time weren't read as like when you put a Switch game into your Switch, your system essentially goes and grabs everything from that game and brings it in and says, okay, I've got the game. Whereas when you put a Super Nintendo in, it's constantly going, okay, what's the next thing that happens? What's the next thing that happens? And so that cartridge can literally be like, what the Super FX chip is doing is just doing math and stuff before the game even makes it to the Super Nintendo. So it just hands the Super Nintendo a polygon and says, here's a triangle. And the Super Nintendo is like, where'd that come from? And the cartridge is just like, don't worry about it, bro. Like, I got you a triangle. And that's all cool. The Super Nintendo knows. Like, it just like, all right, I have a triangle now. which is just, it's not something you can do anymore. And it's a cool concept that relies on an older technology. Like, it wouldn't work today. It doesn't work on a, you know, you could do that on an N64 even. And they did, like, the Star Wars games, famously annoying to emulate because of how many weird chip things they were doing. And you couldn't do that on a PlayStation disc. So it was kind of a weird thing that the N64 actually had over the PlayStation at that time.
It's just that if you were to produce those cartridges, it would be stupid expensive.
Oh, I believe Star Fox was an expensive game. Like, it was at least $10 or $20 more than your average Super Nintendo game. And granted, like, Super Nintendo prices weren't that set in stone compared to like games today. Well, granted, you know, Tears of the Kingdom can be whatever price it wants to be. But like, in general, we have like a set price for games now. But on the Super Nintendo, there was a lot more like just basing it off of how much it cost them to make the cartridge and how big the game was. I guess it would be like today if we actually priced Switch games based on like how big of a cart they had to use.
I mean, that's what they're doing.
That's what Zelda's doing, right?
Yeah.
But like, if Witcher 3 was a $70 game, But some other,
I mean, it's why all your RPGs on Super Nintendo were all like, you know, Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy III were all $90.
Yeah. Need space for all the music. Let's get into some actual history of this game, because it's an expansive tale. So you have to start with Argonaut, which was a English game developer based in London, that was helmed seemingly entirely by children. I think Jez San, the founder, I think was like 16 when he started the company. I'm pretty sure like everyone who went on to work on Star Fox was in their teens. I want to say like Dylan Cuthbert was maybe like 17 or so when he got hired.
I know. I mean, you've literally talked to the man, but I think he was like 18 when he was working on Star Fox.
Yeah. These were children that were all just really good with 3D graphics. Like that was kind of Argonaut's thing, was that they were doing 3D. And I think kind of some context to that is in America and in Japan, home consoles were very big. And that's largely how we were playing video games. In the UK, home consoles didn't really catch on as much, and PC gaming was much more the focus. And so companies like Argonaut were making games pretty much exclusively like for that market, was in that general area. And so within the PC space, like PCs tended to be worse at the time as far as doing like 2D games, like sprites and scrolling and stuff like that. But they got to the point where they could do 3D way earlier. Like Argonaut was releasing, they released Star Glider, which is a wireframe based 3D space shooter in 1986. So while Nintendo was doing stuff on the NES, Argonaut had 3D games.
When the NES launched in America, Argonaut was making 3D games.
Right. So that's how ahead they were as far in relation to where consoles were at that point. With Star Glider, Giles Goddard, who went on to work on Star Fox, did the Atari ST port of Star Glider. And that was, I think, one of the first things he worked on at Argonaut while he was, I assume, like 7 years old. By the time they got to Star Glider 2, they had switched to like fully polygonal 3D graphics. And if you ever look at Star Glider 2, like it is just a beautiful looking game. You can see when you look at it, you can see the Star Fox. Like it's all just completely untextured polygons flying over this kind of like checkerboard grid. It almost looks like the ground levels from Star Fox 2. Like that, there's a very clear through line from that. But then during this time, Dylan Cuthbert got hired at Argonaut. And in 1991, Jez, their CEO, was at, I believe, CES. He was at some sort of electronics show where he was looking at stuff for the Game Boy and was super impressed by it, and went back to Argonaut, I believe with a Game Boy, and said, I want to reverse engineer this, because they couldn't get a dev kit because there weren't any. He said, I want to reverse engineer this and I want to make a 3D game for it. And he went to Dylan Cuthbert because he had learned to program on 8-bit computers. And he's like, this is like what you programmed on, and you got 3D to work on those computers, make it work on this. And also like reverse engineer it, because we don't have a dev kit. So here you go. And so Dylan Cuthbert, either single-handedly or with a very small team, created a demo for the Game Boy called Eclipse that would eventually turn into X or Lunar Chase. And they shopped that around, and it eventually made its way to Nintendo, where the Nintendo execs showed it to Gunpei Yokoi, the guy who designed the Game Boy, who apparently was just like, how in the world? Like, what happened?
What black magic did these British kids do?
Right. How what did they do to my baby? And so Nintendo, I believe at the time, I think it was Midway, there was another company that was going to develop that into a game, and Nintendo stepped in and was like, nope, and bought their shares of it and was like, this is ours, and decided to make it. One thing that I did learn is that so the way, this is very strange, but the way the Game Boy checks for like to make sure you're not using a fake game at the time was when you turn on a game and you see the Nintendo logo pop up, assuming it reads the game right, the system actually looks at exactly where that logo is positioned and what that logo is as its way to verify that that's a real game in there. And that's why, like, if you don't have the game inserted just right and the logo gets all like garbled up or something like that, then the game won't boot past there because the system doesn't think it's a real game. And something that Argonaut did when they were reverse engineering it, and if you get a copy of X, the Nintendo logo before it boots actually, like, it's animated. It doesn't just pop up. It's the only Game Boy game that does this. And then the game boots up. And Argonaut essentially found this way to, like, stop the Game Boy from checking until it got to the exact right point. And then it would check, and then it would get through. So they essentially, like, they defeated, and they did this, like, before they had dev kits. Like, they defeated Nintendo's copyright system in their
demo.
That's
incredible.
Which might have also been why Nintendo was like, we need to buy this.
These children up.
Yeah. So that becomes X or Lunar Chase. Lunar Chase being the English version, which never officially got released. But the ROM was found in the Giga Leak a couple years back and has since disseminated onto the internet.
We both owned repros of it. Yes. And I finally played Lunar Chase and was like, this is cool, but maybe that's not that great. It is bafflingly impressive that it runs on a Game Boy, but it is also very difficult to play because it is a thing that should not exist because it's like a square peg round hole of trying to get something this complex working on a device like the Game Boy.
Yes. Yeah, it's very much, I guess if you haven't played it, it reminds me of like Battlezone on like the old Atari game. It's just like a 3D tank game, all wireframe graphics.
I will say Xscape, the DSiWare game that came out, that by the time you're hearing it, you might have a matter of days.
Like maybe like 4 days. Go quick.
Yeah. But Xscape is actually very good. And it's not that I don't think Lunar Chase is bad. It's just that it is a 3D Game Boy game from 1992. Like that's right. I don't think it's that surprising that I played that in 2022. It was like, oh.
Yeah, it runs it. I mean, it runs at a lower frame rate than Star Fox. I guess I've never tested it, but maybe like 8 frames per second. It's very slow and very simple, but like it boots. It has these like tunnel segments where you can go that would lead to Star Fox. But during that time, I'm not sure exactly when this started, but during that time, Argonaut also started a prototyping process to get their Star Glider game running on the NES, not the Super Nintendo, the NES, and then eventually also created a version for Super Nintendo. And they showed those to Nintendo and said, okay, the good news is we've got 3D running on the Super Nintendo. The bad news is it's just painfully slow. But we could make a chip that would make it actually work. And so Nintendo gave them what would equate today to about $2.5 million and said, okay, do it. And so, and I want to say this was sort of in tandem with X and Lunar Chase being developed. And so they did. They went back and began work on what would become the Super FX chip. Meanwhile, they gave those prototypes to Nintendo, and Nintendo went, yo, Miyamoto, can you make this into a thing? And so Miyamoto took those prototypes and started saying, okay, we're going to narrow this down into a rail line, and started creating what would evolve into the concept for Star Fox.
So it really is. I mean, I think the CS 91, I think it's when there was a winter and a summer CES, because summer CES eventually became E3. Mm-hmm. So really the timeline on this is CES 1991 is when Cuthbert and team started reverse engineering the Game Boy, and Star Fox, not just X, but Star Fox is out within 2 years.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it,
a lot of crunch.
Yeah. Yeah. From absolutely nothing. And keep in mind, X, up until Nintendo bought it, which timeline was must have been maybe sometime halfway in 1991, because it came out in 92. Like that was so a solo.
X was probably in development and for less than a year.
Yeah. Yeah. It was for a good chunk of that time. It was one guy. It was Dylan Cuthbert. And then I believe one other person was helping him build 3D models for it. But the engine was just Cuthbert.
Jesus.
Which is just insane. And then, yeah, that comes out. And like a year later, we have Star Fox. And had all gone to according to plan, 2 years later, we would have had Star Fox 2. Like,
yeah.
The turnaround for this was absolutely insane.
And the fact, I mean, it's the fact that, like, you know, you heard quibbles from me about, you know, X being a rough Game Boy game, and people will definitely say the same things about Star Fox at Super Nintendo. But, like, it's a competent, coherent video game that they made on that type right. of a timeline. It's incredible.
It's, here's the thing about X, made in, like, a year. It's more stable than Pokemon Scarlet or Violet. I mean, that it is like I've played that game a lot. It's never crashed on me.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know, superior game.
A lot simpler, but still true.
Yeah. Similar graphical quality, though, and frame rate. It's comparable in those departments. yes. So 1993, Star Fox comes out, gets very good reviews, sells very well for a Super Nintendo game. You know, it's funny,
especially at that time.
Right. We're a few years into. So when did Super Nintendo come out? Like 1990?
And this was right before Donkey Kong Country came out, because Donkey Kong Country would have been 94.
Donkey Kong was 94. Yeah. So like
92. So it was still when it was kind of. It was also up in the air with like Genesis and Super Nintendo were going head to head for the most part during 93.
And it felt like there was sort of this push to like show which, like there was like a technical battle to like show which one of them could like outpace the other one. Cause that's when you had all of like the blast processing stuff. And Donkey Kong Country, much like Star Fox, was very much a like, look what the Super Nintendo can do. Can the Genesis do that? And it could, but don't worry about that. Honestly, you look at stuff like Virtua Racing on Sega Genesis and like, maybe the Genesis did it better, but like, don't worry about it.
The games, I know Virtua Racing is pretty good.
Virtua Racing is great. The Genesis port of Virtua Racing runs way better than Star Fox and is extremely impressive. Like, we're not taking anything away from that. Especially, and then you compare it to something like Stunt Race FX. And it's, yeah.
Granted, Stunt Race FX
is maybe doing a lot more like physics than that is, but yeah.
So excited to play Stunt Race FX when it came out on Nintendo Switch Lite, and I played it. I'm like, okay, now I can say I played that. I crossed that off the list.
Had you never played it before?
I never played it before that.
It's a, I like it. I don't know. It's super jank. What I would say is that if you ever have trouble enjoying Super FX games, you should hunt down a copy of Vortex, which will definitely never show up on NSO, and play Vortex, and it will instantly make every other Super FX game like way better. Because
I think I've heard. I definitely have seen that one. I don't think I've ever played it.
But yeah, you play as like a transforming mech. It was like Argonaut. Like after Star Fox, the team back at Argonaut then made a game. And it's very much like everything that Miyamoto did with the Star or the SNES Glider demo to take that and go, okay, let's focus this into a refined Nintendo experience. Vortex is Argonaut sort of doing the opposite, like saying like, no, we're Argonaut. We're going to make an Argonaut-ass Argonaut game. It's going to be like really complicated controls, full 3D movement. You're going to be able to transform into like five different vehicles. And it's terrible. And it's borderline impossible to play. It's extremely difficult. And it does really just highlight, like, the Miyamoto guy knows what he's doing. So, comes out in 93, does well, especially for a Super Nintendo game. I believe it crossed a million within a few months, which in Super Nintendo standards is like, good job. It wouldn't be a big hitter on Switch, but you know, it did.
Yeah, it did. People would be like, oh, it only did like 1.5.
Yeah,
like, not a big deal.
I assume in those days Metroid was selling like 7 copies per game or something like that. I think that would be the metric.
Three million is what
3 million. Okay, so
it online.
Which, in Super Nintendo terms, what is the best selling Super Nintendo game, and how many did it sell? Like, what's the range?
Well, Super Mario World is top dog at 20 million,
but that was a pack in.
Yeah,
as was All-Stars.
All-Stars, 10 million. Donkey Kong Country, which I think that was also a pack-in. That's at 9. Super Mario Kart.
By the official connectivity standards, there are only 2 big hitters on Super Nintendo.
Star Fox is the 10th best-selling game on Super Nintendo.
Okay.
It is above Donkey Kong Country 3, Final Fantasy VI, Killer Instinct, F-Zero, pretty much. I think it's above literally every Final Fantasy Dragon Quest game,
canonically twice as good as Mario RPG.
No,
that's how that works.
Yeah, Chrono Trigger is around 2 million. Secret of Mana. Yeah, I forgot how well these RPGs sold on Super Nintendo.
I mean, it was sort of like a... Like, I don't want to say it like popularized them, but like it was sort of like a genesis for Super Nintendo.
Sold more than RPGs. Kirby Superstar, sold more than Super Metroid handily.
Where is Super Metroid at? Oh, 34th place.
It's sold more than pretty much Kirby Superstar and Super Metroid combined.
Honestly, I still feel like 1.5 million would be like decent sales for a Metroid game in modern times.
Yeah. I mean, that's, what do you think Metroid Prime Remastered is going to land at? I'm very curious.
Like,
I guess they probably will report on it, but only in their financials, because I think it is going to be, NPD is going to be useless for it, because digital sales are probably going to drive it.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, like, because the weird thing with that game is it is, like, before Dread, it was the best-selling Metroid game, and it was on a system that nobody bought.
Yeah. Like, also so packing.
So I'm deeply curious to know, like, could that get some insane Switch bump? It is getting like, it's the highest rated game of the year so far on Metacritic.
But John, haven't you heard that's only your nostalgia glasses?
Because of it, the save
checkpoint. No, it doesn't have checkpoints.
I cannot
handle losing 30 minutes of progress in a world where I play roguelikes all the time.
Yes, I love that the audience that plays Elden Ring is like, wait, I have to like go to these areas and save, and all the enemies like respawn immediately when I re-enter.
The thing that pisses me off with that is that, like, if you want to be like, you do a lot of backtracking through Magmore Caverns, like the artifact hunt is kind of rough. Like,
fair.
I agree. I'm not going to fight you on that. Like, I even was talking to someone about it where I'm like somebody that I was talking to was just that, like, I don't know, the 10 seem like it's just like rose colored glasses. And I'm like, I probably wouldn't give this game a 10 if I reviewed it. Like, the artifact hunt, like, it still kind of rubs me the wrong way. Probably go 9 or 9.5. Like, it's still an incredible game. Like, I think it is one of those games that the fact that no one's been able to replicate it makes it feel like untouchable. Like, it, this just makes me, Metroid Prime Remastered makes me endlessly curious to see what the hell Metroid Prime 4 is going to be.
Yeah.
Because if Retro captures lightning in a bottle again, Metroid Prime 4 is going to be incredible, because no one has been able to make that type of game since Retro made it. Like, there's been good attempts at it, but no one has been able to replicate that. Also, probably because the sales limitations for a first person adventure game are pretty low, and Nintendo is one of the few companies that can fund a project that is probably going to cost a lot of money and not really sell that much.
Yeah, it's a weird game to describe to people, like, because I like writing the review for the remastered version. It's a weird game to describe to people because it's looks like a first person shooter.
Yeah,
but I think calling it a first person shooter is an insult both to Metroid Prime and to first person shooters.
It's a 3D Metroidvania. Like, that's
And it winds up like, the best comparison that I have is it's like Riven or Myst or one of those PC first person adventure games that was like point and click. It's like that, but you actually move in. Like, if you play the modern versions of Myst where you're actually moving around in 3D, feels a lot like Metroid.
And it's also much like Ocarina of Time is pretty much Link to the Past but in 3D. Mm-hmm. Metroid Prime is pretty much Super Metroid but in 3D.
Yeah.
And also a key component of every single 2D Metroid is the save point stress. Of where do I find a save? Like, it's the checkpoint thing bothers me so much. And it's like, I'm generally a baby gamer. Mm-hmm. Like, very like Dark Souls doesn't appeal to me as much because, like, I just don't feel like that kind of repetition and like specificity of being good at a game. Like, I kind of just want to sometimes romp through games. But like, you're signing up for a Metroid game. It's, you know, hopefully a modernly designed Metroid game will have some niceties, have your easy mode like Dread added post launch.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to go into Dread and just be like, oh, all these super killer robots, I could just destroy them easily. Like, nah, I want to have it where I might go through a door and like that son of a bitch Emmy is just right there. Like, that's kind of part of the fun. And also the Emmy respawns are very gentle.
I kind of enjoy the save point stress. Like, that was I was going through the like when you first go to the Phazon mines, and it's very combat heavy there for a while with some sparse checkpoints. And that was, I had this moment of like, I'm going through room after room and I'm going, oh, I haven't saved in like 45 minutes. I'm like at the point where I'm like, okay, I can keep pushing. I don't have the map, so I don't know when the next save point is. I'm like, I can keep pushing forward and hope I hit a save point, or I can turn around. And I go, I'm just gonna peek into the next room and see what it is. And I peek in and the door locks behind me. And I go, fuck. Like, so that was, I made it, but it was like, I was literally, I had I was on the last health tank, like 20, it's beeping at me.
I love it.
It's great. I will also say the thing that, so I was in the review, I was thinking about that artifact hunt and I was like, yeah, that'd be like, that's kind of the thing that I don't like about this game. What I found is that replaying it, and it's been a long time since I played through this game, so I didn't remember where any of the artifacts were, but because I'm playing it in a way where I'm always looking in every direction, as opposed to on GameCube where it's like walk forward, stop, hold down the trigger, and then you can kind of look around the room, because I'm always like, I feel like I'm much more aware of the 3D space. I found a bunch of the artifacts long before I needed the artifacts, just because I naturally exploring the environment.
I think my first time through, I might have found one. And like, I think I've talked about it on the show before, where playing Metroid Prime 1, 2, and 3, all of them, I had a moment near the end where I'm like, this is bullshit. And then I like put down the game for a while.
Yeah.
And then eventually finished all three of them. And with three, it was just that, like, it was honestly like, I was like, I need to go take a break and go eat dinner and come back, because the 1 and 3 isn't that big of a deal. I just was like, they're doing it again. And then I was like, this actually isn't that bad. But in 1 and 2, like that last ditch, like, oh, you got to go find all this stuff. But if memory serves, I think 2 does a better job at like telling you to keep an eye out for them before.
Because 1
if you don't know what's coming, you'll just be like, what?
Yes, it is like 1 does give you, like, if you go to the temple, which you never have to go to, but if you happen to go there in advance, like, you can pick up all the hints.
Yep.
First thing, I think all you need is the missile launcher. But even then, like, you're not necessarily looking for them. But yeah, this time around, I was finding them accident. I'd be like, I wonder if there's a missile tank up there. I'd be like, oh, no, it's an artifact. Cool. Awesome. But yeah, that game's awesome. I do hope, I mean, it's getting a really good reception. I hope it does well, and I hope Nintendo takes the right notes from it.
Yeah. And I hope we see better remasters that actually credit the original staff, although...
That would be nice. Honestly, also other people worked on this is like the bar is so low that even that I'm like, oh, that's something. They acknowledged that a previous game existed, which is not the standard.
I am not defending what Nintendo did at all because it's bullshit. But I think it probably has to do with the fact that a lot of people that worked on that game got escorted off the premises for Nintendo. 15 years ago.
The history of retro and Nintendo is not holding hands and skipping through the fields.
Although Matthews, I forget his first name.
I know who you're
talking about. One of the main guys. I think he was one of the people who walked out and formed Armature. Mm-hmm. He did make a good point. Like, I know Mark High Hutchinson, who passed away, also worked on, I believe, like Shadows of the Empire and stuff like that. The fact that he's not credited is a damn shame, because that dude worked on Metroid Prime games and then died very young.
Yeah.
Like, that is the kind of thing where when that guy called it a travesty, like, now I get it. And
yeah,
no matter what bad blood there might be between some of those ex-retro people and Nintendo, like, celebrate the people who passed on.
Yeah,
because they helped build the foundation that is that series, which might not have sold super well historically, but is one of the more like widely respected, critically acclaimed Nintendo things ever.
Well, and in the scope of the Metroid franchise, I think they all sold pretty well. Like, nothing outsold the first one, right? But they all sold reasonably well given what they were. Surely within Nintendo's expectations of them. And it is interesting that this has nothing to do with Star Fox, but we're going. It's interesting when you look at like Metroid Prime Remastered selling that for $40, and then you look at Skyward Sword HD selling for $60. And I've seen people be like, "Oh, well, Skyward Sword was just a texture update," whereas like Metroid Prime is borderline a remake, not even a remaster.
Yeah,
and it really just speaks to like Nintendo's market research saying, all right, if we want to sell Metroid Prime, we need to charge $40. But we can sell Skyward Sword for $60, $10 more than the original game came out for, and people will buy it.
I mean, that's proven true.
I mean, Skyward Sword HD has outsold the original version of Skyward Sword.
Yeah, it's like it's three or four million. And I don't think releasing Skyward Sword HD for $40 was going to increase that number. I think I recall seeing like some commentary of people being like Skyward Sword HD underperformed, and I'm like,
No.
Like it did fine. Like, it's a weird game. It's a little bit of a redheaded stepchild of the Zelda franchise.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool that they brought it back out. Also, like that, I mean, Link's Awakening, I think, is set the bar too high. But Link's Awakening is also a game that was remade that is like, I mean, I don't think the game held up as well. But it is soundly beloved. Like, people call that their favorite Zelda game. Only weirdos that I adore wonderfully call Skyward Sword their favorite Zelda game.
Yes.
It's I love Skyward Sword, but also, like, that is not comparable to the positive reception that Link's Awakening has.
Yeah. It is I do think it's cool that I found out the Metroid remaster is, technically speaking, it's a port, because they never changed engines.
They made the
root engine they developed for the original Metroid Prime and just kept updating it through Metroids and Donkey Kongs, and this is still that same engine, so they were just able to port the original game in and then start replacing assets, which I thought was really cool. But speaking of games that Retro tried to make but didn't, there were a bunch of other Star Fox games after Star Fox, and Star Fox 2 didn't wind up coming out.
I still, we've talked about it before, the last time you did a Star Fox documentary. It is like, I want to see the world. Like, I you know, there's no more racism, world hunger saved, no more right. wars, school shootings are done. If Star Fox 2 came out in like 1995. Because
interestingly, you're also describing the world had Advance Wars never been created. Like, those are the two, either Star Fox 2 comes out or you just don't make Advance Wars, and you either way, you wind up with Utopia.
Yeah. But because I think what happened with Star Fox as a series is Star Fox at Star Fox 64, the best selling entries in the series, set an expectation that Star Fox was supposed to be a rail shooter. You know, 3D rail shooter game, like space opera, Star Wars, but with animals. Like, that's how that game came out to the public. Of your first two entries, similar in scope. Okay, all range mode, get at the Star Fox 64, but it's kind of the same game. If Star Fox 2 came out in between them, Star Fox 2 was like a roguelite with on foot missions and all this crazy nonsense that if that came out, it would have set forth what we've found out from your Star Fox Command interview with Dylan Cuthbert, that like Nintendo and Miyamoto have always viewed Star Fox as this experimental 3D game and not a rail shooter. And you can see that, you know, people might look at Star Fox Adventures or Zero or Command or whatever as like, you know, weird offshoots of what the original two Star Fox games were. But it all follows in that line of experimenting with, you know, 3D games. Like, that's what all of those games are, in a way that as a kid, like, Star Fox Adventures felt like a weird offshoot, but I can see why Miyamoto, through his vision of what Star Fox is and was at the time, that it made sense that Star Fox Adventures would be a part of that. It likely did not feel to some people at Nintendo like that was a weird fit. It just made sense because to them, Star Fox was an experimental 3D series.
Right. Well, and it gatewayed into like the engine, like, especially if you look through like the files for Star Fox 2. And I think some of this is in the first one too. That engine gatewayed into Miyamoto's starting experiments with Mario and Zelda and all of that stuff. Like, even before the N64 came out, they were doing experiments with 3D platforming and all of those games using the Star Fox engine. Like, so even outside of Star Fox itself being about 3D experimentation, it like spawned 3D experimentation. Like, it's like the point from which all of 3D Nintendo comes from.
I mean, like, Super Mario 64 doesn't happen without Star Fox.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's why Nintendo makes 3D games. Obviously, they would have eventually got there, but like,
but it's
in our reality. This is the critical point.
It would be a different path. I mean, you even just look at Giles Goddard's impact on 3D at Nintendo. Like, because what he did the 3D Mario phase in Mario 64.
Yeah.
Then he also he worked on Ocarina of Time, right?
Mm-hmm.
1080 snowboarding, which not like the big hitter. But like 1080 snowboarding is an important 3D game in Nintendo and you know, across the N64. And you don't have Giles Goddard there.
Yeah. Yeah, because he came over with the Argonaut team.
Yep.
And then just when everybody else went back, he was like, I'm gonna stay. And went to Nintendo and they offered him a job and then his boss at Argonaut was like, all right, so new rule. Nobody's allowed to go to Japan and just stay and work for Nintendo, which is probably not a rule that you should be able to make. But like, I also get it. Like, I can understand where if I was hiring all of these really talented employees and then they kept getting poached off by Nintendo, where I would be kind of annoyed, too.
Oh, God, he did the he assisted with the demo of Link fighting an enemy. That was at 1995, the Shinkai, which I believe that was the name for Space World back in 1995.
Yeah.
programmed the interactive Mario face.
Yeah, he did the Mario face and he did Andross's face. And
yeah,
he was just a 3D head guy. Weirdly, didn't do Andross's head in Star Fox 64. So I don't know. I don't know if we know who his his protege head guy was, but somebody took over at some point.
Oh, I forgot that when he left Nintendo, he worked on Doshin the Giant.
Woo!
What are we doing the Doshin the Giant documentary?
Let's do it. I mean, I can... I've got his number.
Can we just talk to Giles more about Doshin the Giant and Feta? Rock and roll climber.
He is credited on Vortex, and I asked him about that, and he goes, I didn't work on Vortex. Like, you're in the credits. And he's like, really? So he went and looked at it. Was like, I guess they must have just credited me because they used some of my code, but like, I didn't touch that game. Hugely important game that set Nintendo on a path.
The 3D. And Star Fox 64. I know I said earlier in the show that I definitely 20 years ago, I preferred the Super Nintendo game. I might still prefer the Super Nintendo game. Actually, the real answer is I think Star Fox 2 is the best of the era.
So here's a weird analogy. Star Fox 64 to me is almost like Mario Kart 8, where like it's this super refined, polished version of a thing that's like it's technically really good, but it lacks kind of the character and charm and uniqueness of the prior entries.
I will say the soundtrack of the Super Nintendo game just whips ass.
Yeah.
Compared to Star Fox. Yeah. The Star Fox 64 soundtrack, it's fine. It's just that the Star Fox Super Nintendo soundtrack is just like bizarre techno synth nonsense. And then Star Fox 64 is just not like, what if Koji Kondo made Star Wars?
Yeah.
Weirdly, and it's still good.
Koji Kondo did one song in the Super Nintendo Star Fox, and it's the slot machine level. That was the only thing. That was otherwise, I think he did like sound effects, but his only song credit in the original Star Fox is the slot machine level for some reason.
So what are your memories of like that gap between 64 and Star Fox Adventures? Like, I mean, you would have been young, but it seems like you were a bit of a Star Fox bug, you know, in the womb. So
I remember that Star Fox Advent. I don't remember that gap being that huge.
I mean, it's what, 97 to 2002, 5 years.
Yeah, 5 years. So like that's not insane. But I do remember like seeing the early screenshots of Star Fox Adventures and being it was like the most beautiful game I had ever seen
it
in my life.
It is still a good looking game.
Yeah, that game has aged as far as a game that goes for, it's not realistic, but like very high fidelity graphical style on a GameCube. I don't think there's any other game that has aged that well. It got brought up in the Discord talking about like Metroid Prime, as far as like, you know, games that you can put in HD and they still look great. No other, maybe Star Wars Rogue Squadron 2 and 3. Would be the only other GameCube games I can think of that hold a candle to Star Fox Adventures.
Yeah, and I mean, I was stoked for Star Fox Adventures. Like, I was very into the 3D Zelda type games of that era. Mm-hmm. And hearing that, like, Dinosaur Planet, which was, I think I remember reading about, like, some of those early demos, the N64 demos of Dinosaur Planet at like E3 and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But one that it was going to be a Star Fox Zelda game. Like all on board, and then I don't think I was not disappointed. I definitely remember playing Star Fox Adventures and being like, well, this isn't as good as Ocarina of Time, which is exactly the kind of comparison that this isn't as good as one of the best games ever made at this time.
Right. Yes.
But I still played through Star Fox Adventures like in those first couple months of when it came out and like enjoyed it, but it definitely, honestly, it was probably colored by the fact that Rare was sold at the same time, so I had to put on my 14-year-old console warrior hat and be like, "Now they're making grab by the
now ghoulies. Now they are the enemy." Yeah,
yeah,
Yeah, no, I will maintain to this day, and especially now that these games are fresh in my mind because of the Game Club, I think it's the best GameCube Zelda game. Wind Waker is close, but I think I still ultimately prefer Adventures. I definitely like it better than Twilight Princess.
I think a monumental
margin.
It's close between that and Twilight Princess for me. It's definitely I like Wind Waker more, but
yeah,
the gap between Wind Waker and Star Fox Adventures is probably a lot smaller than I think.
Yeah, we should just throw it into the Game Club. We got time.
Yeah,
Zelda delay coming? Well, we can do that while Matt's playing Skyward Sword, since he wasn't paying attention when the remaster came out. So like, we all have time. it's like a 20-hour game. It's pretty short.
Yeah, I think I have my copy somewhere. I'll have to dig it up.
Now, given your disappointment with Assault or with Adventures when Assault came out,
Assault was incredible.
Okay.
Assault, I was there day one or close to it. Because I think, 2004, I would have been in high school. I know it was definitely a game. I think it was a February game. So whatever that time of, like, I definitely got Assault very close to after launch. Loved that story mode. I did agree with the comments of the time that, like, maybe the controls, I mean, the fact that it's tank controls across all of it, which if you can just basically, I feel like if you set your expectation that controlling Fox on the ground is just controlling another vehicle that looks like a human, then it's a much better game. That
what's funny is that he controls exactly like Samus in Metroid Prime. Like, that was just how it's the same thing of, like, you walk with the left stick and then you hold down R and you have to stand still and aim. There was dual analog options for that game in the options menu, but nobody knew they were there.
Yeah.
And they probably should have been the default.
I played through that game. I think I even got a good amount of the medals.
Mm-hmm.
And then I played a ton I definitely got some of the medals because I wanted to unlock everything in multiplayer mode, which I had a couple of friends that I played a ton of multiplayer Assault with. And I don't think it is the best Star Fox game. I think it is probably the most criminally underrated one. And there's a lot of criminally underrated Star Fox games.
It's definitely the best Star Fox multiplayer game.
By far.
Like, the multiplayer in Star Fox Assault desperately needs... They could re-release that game without the campaign and just have it be the multiplayer with online support. And I'd be...
Oh my God.
I'd be totally down. Because it's such a crazy sandbox... that really just kind of lets you do whatever you want. It's the only Star Fox multiplayer that wasn't just like, I don't know, you fly around in ships and shoot each other. Like, it was a much deeper experience. Played the crap out of that multiplayer. Star Fox Command came after that. Weird game that I'm a big fan of, was weird in the context at the time of it being heavily inspired by a game that didn't legally exist. We've got a documentary on it. You should watch it. I don't know what else to say about Star Fox Command, because I feel like I've spent an hour talking about it before.
And once again, when you did the documentary, probably talked about it. I think Star Fox Command is fine. I do, after that documentary, I've not gotten around to replaying it. But I think the context of that documentary, and also just where I'm at now versus where I was in like 2009 or whenever I played it, I think I would like Star Fox Command a lot more now.
It's a game where, like, it's disappointing because, like, when we talked to Cuthbert for that documentary, he talked about, like, the stuff that he would have liked to add in. Like, he talked about having wanted to do, like, a wider variety of boss fights so you weren't just fighting the same UFO every time. He wanted to add in rail line missions, so it would be like a 50-50 split. But they were ultimately... Nintendo wanted the multiplayer and all these random features in it because it was an early DS game, and they were so caught up with that they just ran out of time and money to do things that probably would have had a longer lasting effect on people's opinions of the game than like using your voice to be Fox McCloud.
Feels similar story of even what they did with Star Fox 64 3D, where they wanted to emphasize local multiplayer and having your face show up on screen because the 3DS has a camera, when Star Fox 64 3D probably has way longer legs if that multiplayer is online.
Yeah, it is a great that Star Fox 64 3D would be the only remaster that I think Nintendo's ever done that I would compare to Metroid Prime.
It is a gorgeous game.
It was the game that like because I wasn't a super big fan of the DS in general, but I remember seeing the trailers for Star Fox 64 3D and going like, oh, the 3DS is like somewhere like it's way closer to the Wii in terms of power than I thought it would be. Like that's a very pretty game.
Yeah.
The Zelda games on 3DS are also kind of in that Metroid Prime remaster level of like redoing everything, but not quite at the level of visual fidelity that Star Fox did.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we got everyone's favorite Star Fox Zero and Guard, games that we've talked about extensively on this show.
Yeah,
they're good.
I like Star Fox Zero. Yeah, we talked about what it was. Was it the 5 year? Or, God, that was.
Yeah, we did an episode on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Star Fox Zero. I stand by my review that I wrote a long time ago. Star Fox Zero is a good video game, and it is. It is one of those games that when people are like complaining about the controls, I just don't understand it. Like, it clicked for me. And people are just like, just make a control like a normal Star Fox game. I'm like, that's not what the game was made to be.
Yep.
And if you want to say after that, then they should have made a different game. I mean, probably. Sales wise, it probably would have done better.
Like, yeah. I mean, it was a late era Wii U game, so I don't know that. I'm not sure what the high watermark was.
It was cool to see a Star Fox game in HD like that.
Yep.
And Nintendo, even if it was a game that was almost doomed to fail, both by the weird control scheme and the system and time that it came out on, Nintendo put their full force behind it. They tried. And it is a really cool game.
I did stumble. I don't think I've said this on the podcast. I don't even know if I've talked to you about it yet. But I did stumble across some interviews with Miyamoto that I believe they were like post Star Fox Zero launch, where I think it was with Miyamoto. They were talking about how their original idea for that game, like when you saw like the.
Yeah, Miyamoto the pitch with the blurred screen.
Him giving his like pitch for, you know, what the game was going to be and all that. It was apparently not going to have branching paths. It was going to be like much more like he talked about in his initial thing where he was talking about Thunderbirds, like very like episodic, like you would go and join in on an adventure.
Giant robot, Star Fox Guard.
Yeah.
We're all going to be episodes in that.
Yep. And like, so that was his thing. And it was going to be like way more like story focused and over the top. And then I think, honestly, Nintendo just kind of went like, hey, we've got to cut the scope of this thing back.
Yeah.
And that's when we got that quote from Miyamoto saying like, we've adjusted the tone of the cutscenes, is apparently what that means. That's code. And that's why, like we've talked before, I think on that Star Fox Zero anniversary episode about how there's weird, like plot holes in that game and inconsistencies that don't seem to make sense. And so once you consider like, oh, they took this linear episodic game and mix the levels around to make it into a branching path game like Star Fox 64, suddenly all those plot holes start to make a lot of sense. That's what that game wound up being. So it'd be very interesting to see what they intended that game to be before. And then we got finally the most recent official Star Fox game to release being Star Fox 2.
It rules.
Which we already talked about a bit, but incredible game. And I'm very glad that the world eventually got to play it. And then the closest thing we've got to a new Star Fox game on Switch is Starlink Battle for Atlas, which
I still need to play that DLC.
It may have a bunch of other characters in it, but if you look at the sales numbers, I think that was a Star Fox game. There were some sales numbers early on where it was like over 50% of the game's sales were on Switch. Which wasn't a large number, but it was clear that that's where people wanted to play it. Since then, there hasn't been much. I can say that I've been told that there have been one, if not two, Star Fox games that have entered sort of like not full production, but like past the pitch phase and into like the prototyping phase on Switch, but that nothing ever actually came of them. And now we're in a holding pattern to see if anything happens. Hopefully it does, because like we said earlier, it's a game that's more crucial to Nintendo's history than I think people necessarily realize. Because it's very pivotal to the entirety of the N64 and just where they went after the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, I hope Star Fox comes back. Maybe after Pikmin 4 launches, then Miyamoto can start to use his goodwill on another pet project.
Yeah. I suppose if we get Kid Icarus Uprising HD, that counts. Because that is one of the best Star Fox games ever made.
I love that game. I hope Kid Icarus Uprising comes back in some capacity, because that's a game that, I mean, if they can tweak the controls to make them like less arcane, then that game is brilliant.
And as someone who's played it in a waking dream with a dual analog controller, everything that Sakurai said about it not being possible on dual analog, he was lying. Works just fine. I have no idea what he was talking about. It works great. It plays way better than it does on a 3DS without that.
Go Star Fox.
Yay. I think that's pretty much an episode.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening. Thank you for watching if a video version of this came out and that's what you're watching. And if you haven't seen, I don't know what it's called, but some sort of Star Fox 30th anniversary thing that happened on our channel, go watch that. And then I will tease, I don't know the exact timeline of this, but after this comes out, there will be a video we are producing in collaboration with the Video Game History Foundation. I won't say what it is, but it's going to be cool and you should watch it. So keep an eye out for that. If you're not subscribed to their YouTube channel, go do it. They have some crazy stuff over there. Sometimes it's just like footage of games that they've just like, yeah, we found this. And other times it's like more kind of documentary style stuff, which was probably edited by me, and you should watch it. There's even a video of me talking about Earthbound, which is the only place you'll see me saying positive things about Earthbound, because I didn't write the script.
And I'll call this out. One of the Video Game History Foundation folks, Kelsey Lewin, is writing a book on Animal Crossing. That is legitimately, I'm very, very excited for this, because she... Yeah. I recall her and Frank Cifaldi talking on one of the Video Game History Hour podcast episodes about Cabbage, which is this like, I don't even think there's that much out there of this N64 prototype that was like not necessarily directly Animal Crossing, but clearly had a big impact on what Animal Crossing was and was kind of like the evolutionary step before it. Mm-hmm. But that was a while ago, and if Kelsey found out a lot about Cabbage, then there's going to be a lot of cool Cabbage content in that book that I'm very excited to check out. She's a good
investigator and historian, so I would assume that she may have. Yeah, no, I'm... that may actually be the first... boss fight books are always those books that I'm like, I should buy those. I have friends who recommend those, and I never do.
Some are behind me in that bookshelf. Video people.
But yeah, this might be the one that I would actually get, because I would enjoy it. I'm sure my wife would enjoy it.
You'd really like the Majora's one.
That's the one that's kind of on my to-do list.
I should. They sent me two copies, because I did the Kickstarter for one of them. They sent me two copies of the Katamari book, which I should just send you one of them, because
I'll read it. The
Katamari book's a really good read, because it does just go into the toy like design ethos of Kid Takahashi. He is one of the most fascinating game designers, because it's just a completely different approach than what you see most people make games with.
I listened to the soundtrack of that game today. It's a good soundtrack, man.
I can't wait for We Heart Katamari.
I should buy the other Switch one that's already out.
That's good.
One of these days I'll get around to playing all the games.
Nintendo Switch Online, like a free trial soon.
Oh, that's true.
That was mentioned in the Direct.
Yeah, as there's a lot in that Direct.
Too much.
It wasn't. Spread Katamari it out. Isn't a big hitter, though, so I didn't pay much. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Rate us if you're at a place where you can rate us. go back and see if you missed any episodes, because we disappeared from your podcast feed for like 2 weeks. So like double check, because you may have missed things. Same goes for the rest of the NWR podcasts. If you listen to like RFN, or I think Talk Nintendo was only gone for like a day. But if you listen to any of those, go double check. Make sure you got all the episodes. Bye, guys.
Bye.